died was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, Wide Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian resistance will not leave the prisoners alone and will do all it can to secure their release. Resistance factions have secured the release of over 1,000 prisoners since 2011 and will force the Israeli regime to free more prisoners. Our enemy only understands the language of force. The Palestinian resistance will alleviate the suffering of Palestinian prisoners.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits.
I have been suffering for more than 30 years while waiting for my son to be free. When he was arrested, I was 40 years old, and now I am over 70. I pray to God to keep me alive so that one day I can hold my son in my arms. Every night I cry myself to sleep worrying about my son.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors.
We are extremely worried about our sons and daughters inside Israeli jails. My son has been in jail for 7 years and I was able to visit him only twice. The situation inside Israeli prisons is extremely difficult and all Palestinian prisoners are suffering, especially due to medical negligence and the inhumane treatment.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. People here are demanding international protection for Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea.
The demilitarized zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife.
Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Shirwan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food with each other, but it's fun.
Cranes are considered a sacred symbol of longevity and fortune here and designated a national monument. Frank Smith, South Korea.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, challenges of a family life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about some challenges of the family life, where the challenges when they come and the difficulties that people face is because when they get married, they do not follow the right criteria. When they're looking for the spouse, when they're looking for a life partner to marry, they are not following the real criteria which is set in the Quran. For example, in the Quran, Allah said, وَلَا تَنْكِحُ الْمُشْرِكَاتِ حَتَّى يُؤْمِنَّ. Do not marry the polytheist women or unbelievers until they become believing men. وَلَا أَمَةٌ مُؤْمِنَةٌ خَيْرٌ مِنْ مُشْرِكَةٍ. And even if a lady who is mu'mina, who is a believing woman, even if she does not have anything, or maybe she is from a low class, she is better than a mushrika, a polytheist woman who even is wealthy. وَلَوْ أَعْجَبَكُمْ. Even if you are amazed of such thing, you're amazed that how can Allah say that a mu'mina, a believing woman, is better than a non-believing woman. This is because then you will have your kids. Your kids will be grown according to what you believe in. And if you marry someone else who is from another religion, then obviously the kids are generally all confused. And this is being injustice with the kids to follow, to marry someone who is not from your faith. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of some challenges of the family life, and we said that if a person marries someone who is not same in belief as he is or she is, then there is a challenge for kids as well. And this is being unjust to the kids. Why? Because kids get confused that to whom to follow. Because when they look at the father, for example, he is praying on the mat, he goes to the mosque. And on the other hand, if the wife or the mother of the kids is a non-believer, then she might go to the clubs, pubs, or maybe if she's a Christian, she will go to the church. And here is the problem, that these kids, who should they follow? Or even if the wife is Muslim or the husband is non-Muslim, then the real challenge is for the kids. And here we are doing injustice to the kids. Even for the Christians, they should marry Christians. The Jews should marry Jews. The Muslims should marry Muslims. Why? Because when we are having kids, we need to give them peace in the house. And this peace can come when you both, like the husband and wife, are from the same, we can say, religion, or they have same beliefs. And if they do not have same beliefs, then it can lead into some dialogues which can harm kids in future. So therefore, when the kids are there, even this family, if we want a peace in this family, we need to follow this formula. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that even if a woman or a man, if they are believers, if even they are from a lower class, marry them. Why? Because they are following the same path. They are one with you in the faith. And this will bring a peace in your life. And Allah says, وَاللَّهُ يَدْعُوا إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ. And Allah calls you towards the paradise, وَالْمَغْفِرَةِ, and forgiveness. Therefore, we need to follow him, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
in the limelight.
On the day that Martin Reynolds, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's principal private secretary, encouraged colleagues to congregate and enjoy the hottest day of the year in a garden party in No. 10 Downing Street on 20th of May 2020, the Met Office tweeted a warning that whatever the weather, the public was obliged to stick to COVID rules, and fines were issued to those who did not. We now present you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Severin Carroll, Nicola Davis and Peter Walker. The piece is titled Furious Tories Pile Pressure on Boris Johnson Over No. 10 Parties. Please stay with us for more. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing intense pressure from senior Conservatives to publicly confess he attended a rule-breaking garden party in Downing Street, with the Scottish Tory leader suggesting the Prime Minister should resign if he broke COVID rules. A string of Conservative MPs openly expressed anger and humiliation about the gathering of up to 40 people on 20th of May 2020 after it emerged in a leaked email. Others called on him to come clean and apologise in the hope of stemming rising fury. Boris Johnson has declined to say whether he and his then-fiancée, Carrie Symonds, attended the event. About 100 Downing Street staff were invited by Martin Reynolds, Johnson's principal private secretary, to attend the party. The former minister, John Mercer, described the revelations as humiliating, while the MP for Kylie, Robbie Moore, said, "The email from Martin Reynolds infuriates me. I have no idea what these people were thinking." Caroline Noakes, another former minister, said, "I have no words that can adequately express how angry I am at the 'don't do as I do, do as I say' attitude that appears to have prevailed in Downing Street." Mark Harper, the chair of the influential COVID recovery group, said, "These are serious allegations. The Prime Minister will be in the House of Commons in the coming days, and I wait his explanation with interest." Privately, more Tory MPs said they were waiting for Boris Johnson's explanation at Prime Minister's question time. One said he should fess up, take responsibility personally and apologise. Not one of these pretend apologies, but a proper apology. Another said, "It is so disgusting. I just feel I have been lied to. I just think the whole operation is a liability." They added that Tory MPs were exchanging angry messages on WhatsApp about how reluctant they are to expend political capital defending Boris Johnson. A third former minister warned, "None of this is yet irretrievable, but this is another notch on the dial. We're moving up the scale from retrievable to irretrievable." Douglas Ross, the leader of the Conservatives in Scotland, told Scottish TV he was furious that while other Britons were banned from seeing dying or hospitalised relatives, people at No. 10 Downing Street were drinking and enjoying the sunshine out the back of No. 10. Douglas Ross said he could no longer back the Prime Minister if he was found to have attended the event and then failed to stand down. He said, "I would not in any way support the Prime Minister if he broke the law and attended that party." Douglas Ross suggested the controversy could prompt more Conservative MPs to send letters to Graham Brady, the chair of the 1922 committee, in a concerted bid to trigger a vote of no confidence. He said, "These are discussions I know that colleagues will be having in Westminster." If Sir Graham Brady receives 54 such letters, a vote of no confidence will be triggered. And if Johnson were to lose that vote, a leadership contest would be launched in which he would not be allowed to stand. Senior Conservative said that the mood in the House of Commons tea room on Tuesday, 11th of January, was funereal, with MPs discussing who would replace Johnson. One MP said that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, could be Prime Minister within months. The MP said, "It is no longer a question of if the Prime Minister will go, it is when." Professor Stephen Riker of the Scientific Pandemic Insight Group on Behaviour, which advises the government, warned that the continuing row over parties risks undermining key public health guidance. He said, "It is a massive distraction with all the attention on parties. The government cannot do its job of communicating clearly about the pandemic and what should be done about it. Secondly, it polarizes and politicizes the debate about the pandemic and so undermines the sense of community which is critical in securing adherence." The latest Tory backlash was sparked by a leaked email from Martin Reynolds, Boris Johnson's principal private secretary, that invited colleagues to socially distance party after an incredibly busy period. At the time, two people from different households, but no more, were permitted to meet outdoors in a public place at a distance of 2 meters under England's pandemic rules. The junior minister, Michael Ellis, was sent out by Downing Street to parry MP questions at an angry and emotional session in the House of Commons on Tuesday, 11th of January. The DUP MP, Jim Shannon, broke down in tears as he said his mother-in-law had died alone during lockdown, urging the government to ensure full and complete disclosure of what happened. Michael Ellis apologised for the upset that these allegations have caused. He confirmed that an inquiry by the senior civil servant, Sue Gray, would consider Downing Street gatherings on 15th and 20th of May 2020, as well as the following Christmas, but sidestepped further questions. Leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, is expected to accuse the Prime Minister of misleading Parliament about the gatherings when he faces him across the dispatch box soon. When news broke of a number 10 Downing Street Christmas party in 2020, Boris Johnson told MPs all guidance was followed completely. A few days later, though, when a video emerged of his former press secretary, Allegra Stratton, joking about a party, he said he was sickened and furious. Michael Ellis told MP that Sue Gray's report would establish the facts, and if wrongdoing is established, there will be requisite disciplinary action taken. Asked whether Boris Johnson would resign if he was found to have broken the law, Michael Ellis said the Prime Minister was going nowhere and retains the confidence of the people in this country. Senior Tory MPs called for Boris Johnson to carry out a radical shake-up of the number 10 machine in the wake of the shock defeat in North Shropshire by-election last month, but no changes have so far been announced. A snap survey by pollster Savanta Combres found that two-thirds of the British public think Boris Johnson should resign after the latest revelations. Even among Conservative voters, the figure was as high as 42%. One Johnson loyalist said it will be the honourable statesman-like thing to do and to say, "Look, I was wrong." He could do something about this, and the trouble is, he keeps leaving us all high and dry. Sue Gray is now charged with ascertaining the facts regarding a party that Boris Johnson himself is charged to have attended, and on which he has refused to comment publicly before reporting them to him. This black farce brings politics into disrepute at a time when trust between the governed and the governing remains vital in the management of the pandemic. The millions of Britons who obeyed COVID rules in often heartbreaking circumstances can only rely on the respected Miss Gray to do her job rigorously. But the Metropolitan Police should prepare to launch their own inquiry into a saga which has scandalized the nation and which now directly implicates the Prime Minister in wrongdoing. On the day that Martin Reynolds encouraged colleagues to congregate and enjoy the hottest day of the year, the Met Office tweeted a warning that, whatever the weather, the public was obliged to stick to the COVID rules. Fines were issued to those who did not. No healthy democracy can allow the perception to take root that certain powerful people are above the law, least of all during a public health crisis of the first order. Yet this is what Boris Johnson has allowed to happen. The Prime Minister will hope to bluster his way through, as he has done so often before, but if he's found to have egregiously flouted the rules and misled Parliament, he should pay the price.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
لیس للانسان الا ما سعى. انسان در گرو تلاش خودشه.
الله in the Holy Quran Surah An-Najm ayahs 37 to 41 states that no bearer shall bear another's burden and that nothing belongs to man except what he strives for and that he will soon be shown his endeavor, then he will be rewarded for it with the fullest reward. From these ayahs of the Quran, we understand that all of our deeds are counted, and the more we try our best in this world, the more rewards we will be given in the other world. We must take into account that everyone is only responsible for his own deeds, and no one shall be chastened for the deeds of others. Sometimes we see that people are deceived easily by some who claim that they accept the consequences of their bad deeds. and everybody will be questioned for his deeds in this world.
بدبخترین مردم کسی هستند که گوله یربا رو میخوره.
The most wretched people are those who are easily deceived by such words. On the day of judgment, everyone will be shown his records of deeds, and everyone is rewarded according to his own deeds. Allah bestowed on us the power of recognition, the power of discern between good and bad. We can't deceive ourselves by claiming that we are not aware of the consequences of bad deeds, or we were trapped by the tricks of the wrongdoers. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
As Iran leaves behind one death anniversary right after New Year, it commemorates two other assassinations too. Those are of the nuclear scientists Ali Mohammadi and Ahmadi Roshan. They were murdered respectively on January the 12th, 2010 and January the 11th, 2012. He was a professor setting out for work at Tehran University. But what Masoud Ali Mohammadi didn't know was that that morning there was a remote-controlled bomb attached to his car. The blast killed him and injured two other people. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists have met fates similar to his since 2007, with Israel being the prime suspect. For a look at these incidents and the why and how of them in a context of Israeli state terrorism, stay with me, Leila Faromaizi, on Iran Today. As for Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, he was assassinated 2 years later. How it happened was a magnetized explosive was attached to the side of his car on his way to work by a team of motorcycle riding assailants. The blast also hit his driver Reza Ghashghari, who later died from the injuries. Western intelligence sources said Ahmadi Roshan was a victim of Israel's intelligence agency Mossad. Mossad secretly uses extraterritorial locations and employs locals to carry out its killings abroad. In connection with the Ahmadi Roshan assassination, it was Arash Kerhatkish who came under interrogation to admit, "In this location, meaning Ketabi Square, Golnabi Street, we reached the car and attached the bomb to the car and the bomb exploded near the white fence," as reported by Mehr News Agency. Let's hear it in an expert's words, why there's no doubt of Israeli culpability. Mr. Pakayun was ambassador and his views draw on years of diplomatic experience. He now receives us at his beautiful home adorned with memorabilia from his postings.
خب روزنامه کرونیکل یکی از روزنامه‌های نزدیک به
The Chronicle is one of the newspapers close to Israel. The paper published an article written by Jake Simmons that exposed Israel's role in the assassination of Mr. Ali Mohammadi in 2009, as well as sabotage attempts in Natanz and Karaj nuclear facilities. The point I didn't mention was that Israel, in addition to assassinating Iran's nuclear scientists, is trying to sabotage Iran's nuclear facilities in Natanz and Karaj. Unfortunately, some of the information leaked by IAEA inspectors to Israel has helped them conduct operations, all in violation of international law, at various times against Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
According to Time of January the 13th, 2012, it was told by Western intelligence sources that like three Iranian scientists already ambushed on their way to work, Ahmadi Roshan was a victim of Israel's Mossad. On June the 17th, 2012, the then Iranian intelligence minister, Haydar Moslehi, announced the arrests of a team of 20 people, blaming the attack on the CIA, Mossad and MI6, the British intelligence agency. Mr. Bharati is a political analyst with attention to detail in relating and analyzing incidents. So we made a trip deeper into Tehran for an interview with him.
با توجه به نوع کار و اینکه جنس کار از جنس اقداماتی
Given the method and the violent nature of the operation, which is in violation of international law, the likes of which took place in other countries, including Iraq, it can be concluded that Israel was behind the operations. This has been confirmed by informal sources, media and others. For example, in Israel's latest terrorist move, the case of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination, media close to Israel's intelligence agencies published and leaked the details of the operation.
A Mossad agent, Majid Jamali Fashi, was sentenced to death for his role in the killing of Ali Mohammadi. Three other nuclear scientists heard magnetic bombs snap onto their car doors during their commute to work, a method Fashi claimed he had also been taught by the Israelis. Besides Ahmadi Roshan and Shahriari, the victims include Fereydun Abbasi, a university professor who survived and was promoted to head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. It was the 29th of November when both men, Abbasi and Shahriari's cars, were approached by men on motorbikes who stuck magnet bombs to the side of cars. Majid Shahriari was killed on the spot and his wife was wounded, while Fereydun Abbasi Davani and his wife were both wounded. The explosions happened in front of Shahid Behesht University. Israel has committed an ongoing series of assassinations and sabotage in Iran, presumably with the backing of America. Our guests of the day will help verify. Western intelligence sources, as a matter of fact, said in 2012, in addition to the assassination campaign, Israel was responsible for the massive explosion at a missile base outside of Tehran in November. Enlisting some American-Israeli hostilities, Mr. Bharati remembers the scientists lost to this country. As for America, with Trump's departure from the JCPOA, not only was the spirit of the JCPOA not preserved, but actions were taken completely contrary to the original text of that deal.
In 2009, Rasul Ali Mohammadi was assassinated. That was an extraordinary year for the Islamic Republic, as we were dealing with the aftermath of Iran's presidential elections, and there was a particular confusion inside the country that was perhaps unprecedented at the time. Back then, Israel took advantage of the turmoil and assassinated an effective person in Iran's nuclear program. About a year later, we lost Dr. Shahriari in a similar assassination. Almost everyone is certain that Israel perpetrated the assassination. If you follow the developments of Iran's nuclear program, there was a period of time when Iran was running out of fuel for the Tehran Research Reactor, where medicine used to treat cancer produced. It was running out of fuel with a 20% purity level. Iran announced to the negotiating parties that it requires fuel. They, in turn, started to play games, as they thought they could take many concessions from Iran. It was the efforts of such men that made Iran self-sufficient in this field.
It was between the two sets of assassinations of 2010 and 2012 that Dariush Rezai Nejad was shot 5 times and killed near his house on July the 23rd, 2011, by a team of motorcycle-riding gunmen. It was after he had picked up his daughter from kindergarten, and the attack left both his daughter and wife injured. Germany's Der Spiegel said in August of the same year, 2011, that Mossad was behind the operation. As for the most recent attack, it was on an ace nuclear scientist on the 27th of November 2020. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's car was targeted by an explosion and machine gun fire in Damavand's Absad. That's 40 kilometers to the east of Tehran. Mossad had apparently gained access to Fakhrizadeh's name via a UN list. Ali Shamkhani, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, said that electronic equipment was used in the highly complicated assassination of Fakhrizadeh, underlining the role of Israel and the anti-Iranian MEK or MKO, Mojahedin-e Khalq organization. All indications point to Israel as the main culprit. There's concrete circumstantial evidence galore, such as similarities between operations, as well as intelligence reports from neighbors and Western states, and accusations by Western allies of Israel, and the occasional admission by Israeli authorities. And let's not forget Israeli media reports.
رسانه‌های رژیم صهیونیستی معمولاً بعد از هر تروری رسماً اعلام کردند.
Israeli media have announced Tel Aviv's involvement after every assassination. Mossad officials announced they assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. American and European officials and media have repeatedly said there are traces of US and Britain's involvement in the assassinations and that their intelligence services aid the assassination of the nuclear scientists, which is a clear example of state terrorism.
Would Israel dare carry on as it does had it not been for American support, or at least a go-ahead?
I believe Israel can be seen as opposing U.S. policies. The two complement each other on deeper and hidden levels. There are strategic issues that can explain the matter. One is a good cop, bad cop, and another is a strategic pattern. On the surface, the two have different opinions on the matter, and you'd want to cooperate with the good cop to avoid dealing with the bad cop. But the reality is that they both see the same thing. As you can see, the talks we've had with the P5 Plus One over the past 8 years, including with the US itself, didn't prevent Israel's assassinations and sabotage attempts. I argue that the talks actually made the matter worse and enabled Israel to perpetrate them more easily. The reason is that we provided the International Atomic Energy Agency unprecedented access to inspect our nuclear facilities under the 2015 deal. We went beyond the additional protocol. There are different levels of cooperation with the agency. One at the level of NPT and safeguards, one at the level of the additional protocol, and the other was our permission to inspect and install monitoring cameras and other supervision techniques to the IAEA. Almost everybody knows that whatever the IAEA finds is almost certainly provided to Western intelligence services, including that of Israel.
Talking of Israeli interest within a context of Western support or contradiction, that Zionist entity's sabotage of Iran's nuclear program is as old as the program itself, at least post-revolution. And it does not seem to care if the program is for peaceful purposes.
Well, Israel has been opposing JCPOA talks. Tel Aviv managed to convince the UN Security Council, with the help of the US, to issue 4 resolutions against Iran and impose sanctions on Tehran. Israel managed to persuade Europe to impose sanctions on Iran's banking sector and oil sales. But after the talks started and Iran proposed its strong logic in the negotiations, all four resolutions were repealed and the world realized Tehran is seeking peace.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
A 20% uranium enrichment capacity was a target for producing medical isotopes and the like. But with Western parties' failure to commit to the JCPOA or nuclear deal, Iran has been enriching uranium up to 60%. It is now looking to results with the sanction-lifting Vienna talks to reverse its nuclear activity yet again. But Israel is uneasy with the West coming to terms with Iran all the same. Interestingly, a revival of the JCPOA and therefore U.S. sanctions being lifted off Iran may yield minimal results for this country. Yes, it will be able to extract and export oil to its standard levels at global prices. But after America's deal-breaking in 2018, major Western companies will no longer dare enter into business with us. Not until they can be sure of U.S. commitment to the deal. And the downside is, former U.S. President Donald Trump, who binned the deal in 2018, could make a comeback in 2024. However, Iran can get by, even if only oil and banking sanctions are lifted.
روی کرده خونسازی به این معنی هست که اگر آمریکایی‌ها
Taking the neutralization approach means that if the Americans don't remove the sanctions, we can resort to other means to strengthen our economy and find trusted partners to sell our oil, take in the revenue and export our non-oil products and transfer money. We've gathered enough experience of how to do that under sanctions. This means we can move towards a situation where the sanctions have the least harmful effect on Iran.
Plenty more on the matter coming up, but first a quick media review with Mohammed.
Welcome to another news section. I'm Mohammed Ghoit, and in this episode, we are discussing Iran's nuclear program and Israel's acts of sabotage and terror against it. First, we have a report by the New York Times titled Iran's Nuclear Program Ignites New Tensions Between the U.S. and Israel. According to the report, long-running differences over how to deal with Iran's nuclear program have erupted into new tensions between the Biden administration and Israel, with two senior Israeli officials leaving Washington this week concerned that the Americans' commitment to restoring the 2015 nuclear deal will lead to a flawed agreement allowing Tehran to speed ahead with its nuclear enrichment program. The report goes on by saying the strains were evident all week as the Biden administration sought to bring the alliance with Israel into a united front about how to deal with Iran over the next year. But at the heart of the tensions between Israel and the United States is the fundamental disagreement over how to approach the Iranian nuclear program. It is not a new argument. The two allies fought bitterly over the 2015 agreement which Israel opposed and President Barack Obama signed. More recently, they've disagreed about the wisdom of the Israeli sabotage of Iranian facilities, which Mr. Bennett's government believes has set back the program, and which some in the United States argue only encourages the Iranian to build back the nuclear enrichment facilities with more efficient and up-to-date equipment. Meanwhile, a report published in the Financial Tribune says sustainable sanctions relief is the only way to address the nuclear standoff. The report cites a Middle East specialist saying the only way to address Iran's nuclear issue is for the United States to lift its economic sanctions and ensure sustainability of the 2015 nuclear deal from which it once withdrew unilaterally. If the US does, Iran for its part will fully implement its commitments under the JCPOA permanently. That's what Hossein Mousavian said in an article published by the Middle East Eye. Mousavian also offered two other scenarios, the first being what many Israeli officials are advocating, a US military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities in case of a failure to restore the JCPOA. I believe that this is a bluff to put more pressure on Iran. The US is in no mood to launch a new war in the Middle East, he said. The second scenario would be a continuation of Trump's failed strategy of maximum pressure, namely full-blown economic, political, and cyber wars with sabotage including continuing Israeli covert attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinations of its nuclear scientists. Thanks for joining me in this episode's news section. And now, back to data.
Now, regarding the extent to which Israel might be able to influence the Vienna talks, which are moving in the direction of an understanding between Iran and Western parties to the deal, given Israel's weakened position with the Islamic Resistance Axis having surrounded it, its apartheid government, and its being a UN member without having signed up with the NPT, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, its allies appear less zealous in supporting it.
The French government and Mr. Macron said Israel is taking a path that leads to apartheid. The racism and apartheid in Israel, which is internationally reprehensible, together with its inability to manage itself and the COVID-19 pandemic, which has turned into a real problem for Tel Aviv, is prompting mass migrations from Israel.
Also, even if it's just a game of good cop, bad cop between America and Israel in dealing with Iran, America has come to realize that warlike hostility towards Iran is only pushing this country closer to independence, with a nuclear program that has been indigenized and is working faster and more efficiently than before. The one thing that had limited the program was the nuclear deal that the US ditched. We now have Mr. Hanizadeh, an analyst worth hearing, even if only online.
The Israeli foreign minister's visit to European countries to stop the progress made in Vienna talks have failed. The differences between U.S. President Joe Biden's team and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has prevented Tel Aviv from sabotaging the talks during the 7th and 8th round of negotiations. That's why it appears that Israel is no longer likely to be able to affect the process of talks in Vienna, since it has exhausted all its political and economic capabilities. Despite all that, good progress is made in the talks, and the Israeli regime will suffer defeat soon.
The assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientists aside, in the 20 months running up to November 2021, there had been 4 explosions at Iranian nuclear facilities attributed to Israel. Explosions that took uranium enrichment plants offline and destroyed dozens of centrifuges. Noting this and the fact that Iran had managed to resume enrichment within months, often installing newer machines that can enrich uranium far faster, US officials reportedly gave a friendly warning to the Israelis that while preemptive attacks and assassinations may be tactically satisfying, they are ultimately counterproductive.
Over the past 10 years, Israel attempted to conduct sabotage operations in Natanz and Karaj nuclear facilities 9 times, 3 of which were successful, and 6 others were stopped. The regime is trying to either assassinate Iranian scientists or attack Iranian nuclear facilities directly. Relevant institutions are vigilant and have been able to neutralize the regime's attempts to carry out sabotage operations in Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
In improving its modern warfare defenses, Iran made sure to cover the cyber field. This would make it much harder to pull off cyber attacks such as Stuxnet, That was the U.S.-Israeli stunt that crippled centrifuges at the Natanz nuclear enrichment site for more than a year. Stuxnet, being a malicious computer worm first uncovered in 2010, which targets supervisory control and data acquisition systems. With all the economic pain inflicted on Iran because of U.S. sanctions, there's no telling the United States has any more leverage over this country than it did in the run-up to the 2015 nuclear deal. And that's not just because of Iranian policy, but the U.S.'s own policy of taking an aggressively hostile stance towards the European Union over Iran. Because this has made the EU rethink its reliance on the U.S. Just as a reminder, the 2015 nuclear deal, which became operational in 2016, was to award Iran relief from nuclear-related economic sanctions imposed on it by the UN in return for Iran rolling back its nuclear program, which Iran did do. Now, Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of nuclear warheads, the number of which it keeps secret.
Israel has 11 active nuclear plants and an area smaller than 22,000 square kilometers, the biggest of which is Dimona, located in the southern Negev desert, which is producing plutonium at a 98% purity level. Dimona is one of the most polluting nuclear plants in the world, dumping some 30 tons of nuclear waste into the Mediterranean Sea. The Eastern Mediterranean is witnessing more environmental pollution year by year. This is one of the environmental dangers threatening the region.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years, accusing it of secretly developing nuclear weapons for use against Israel. He advocated for no less than crippling sanctions and even war against this country. Now, Israel is the entity it is. Its invasive founding has, yes, caused it to base its survival on terrorism. What's astounding is how international conventions and organizations haven't taken it upon themselves to respond appropriately. Israel's acts of hostility in this country are as old as Iran's nuclear program itself. Why is it that the global community, even international organizations, have sat quiet?
The most important reason is that there are international organizations like the IAEA, which is an agency that has to strive to prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons and at the same time protect the country's rights to have peaceful nuclear programs and their scientists and facilities. But they don't provide that support. The year after the assassination of Mr. Fakhrizadeh, IAEA Secretary General Mr. Grassi hasn't taken action or condemned the move. These institutions are legally under the control of dominant powers, which in this case is the United States.
That'll be it for today. Long live the memory of those who served. Thanks for staying with us to review legacies. Do join us again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question that a lot of sisters often bring up. And this is a question regarding the conditions of the believers in paradise. Sometimes sisters ask us, well, all of the descriptions of the believers and their states in paradise all are all about men. For example, men are going to get this, men are going to get that. And it doesn't mention anything about the blessings and rewards that women are going to get. One of the, to be more specific, Sisters ask us, in the Quran it says that, men are going to be rewarded with hur. But it doesn't necessarily say anything about what women are going to get. Are they going to be given beautiful spouses and concubines in heaven or not? And if not, then isn't this a discriminatory practice against women? What's the answer to this question? So, in order to answer this question, in general, first of all, in Islam, there is no difference between men and women as far as the potential that they have to reach perfection, spiritual perfection, right? Both men and women, both of them in Islam, have been given. God has given both genders the ability and the capability to achieve spiritual perfection. And if they perform their religious duties and are obedient to God, they can achieve the spiritual perfection. There's no difference between men and women from this point of view. This is a general principle within Islam. At the same time, in heaven, we know as general that people will be given whatever they desire, all of the rewards and blessings that they want and they desire. So there's no reason to believe that a certain blessing would be specifically allotted to men and not women. Now, specifically related to the question of the Hura'in, which has been mentioned in the Holy Quran, one verse in the Holy Quran says this, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَلَهُمْ فِيهَا أَزْوَاجٌ مُطَهَّرَةٌ. For them, there are purified spouses. Now, here, the pronoun hum in the word lahum, this refers to the people who abide in heaven, regardless of whether they are men or women. It's not specifically related to men. It doesn't specifically refer to the men. At the same time, the word azwaj in Arabic is the plural of zawj. And this word zawj, it refers to spouse. It's not specifically referred to a wife. It is not the word azwaj is not the plural of zawja, which means wife. It's the plural of zawj, which means spouse. That spouse could be a man or it could be a woman. It could be a wife. It could be a husband. Right. So there's no reason to say that this verse specifically related to men and that men will be given beautiful spouses, whereas the women will not be given such a blessing. Another way that we can answer this question is by referring to another verse of the Holy Quran, which says, "Wazawajnahum behure'in." Right. So, in this verse, it's necessary to analyze this verse and see what the word hure'in is. When we analyze this from a linguistic point of view, we say that the word hur is the plural of ahwar, and also the plural of Hawra. The word Ahwar means a man with beautiful black eyes, and the word Hawra refers to a woman with beautiful black eyes. And at the same time, the word Een is the plural of Ayun, which means a man with big eyes, and also the plural of Aina, which refers to a woman with big eyes and big beautiful eyes. So there's no reason to say that this word specifically refers to wives and not husbands. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir. IRIB English Radio.